Hi, I'm Josh Spafford. I'm 35. It's May the 3rd, 2008. I'm in the StoryCorps booth in Grand Central, and I'm with my friend Mark Nelson. Hi, Mark.
Hello. My name is Mark Nelson. I am 40 years old, hoping not to be 41 when we're continuing these. Today is May 3rd. We're in Grand Central Terminal, and I am talking to Joshua Spafford. So, a couple cleanup things from our last tape. I mentioned on the tape that wow, man, I'm really losing that thought. That one just went right out.
You've completely forgot?
It's just like a complete
blank.
Alzheimer's there setting in. Okay, well, let's start with something different then. I know what I was going to say. I was going to say that I mentioned that George, George gave that photo album to Steve, and that's not correct. Actually, George died, and then Steve gave the photo. Then June, the widow,
right?
Either your granddad's fourth or fifth wife, depending on who you ask.
It's yeah,
a little murky, even to the kids.
Yeah,
gave the photo album to Steve. So I just wanted to be clear about that, that wasn't a gift from George to Steve.
That's good.
So, you know, maybe inadvertently June opened up the can of worms by doing something she thought was quite a nice thing, giving Steve all of this material that George had actually asked to be destroyed.
Because he asked for everything to be destroyed.
Yeah, exactly. So we left here last time, and we were talking, and we left with the Lillian Lenorak letter, which is a pretty incredible document. But before we get to that, we have to start with, I can't let you quite off the hook on this one. We got to go back to the doctor's bag for just a second.
Sure. I'm happy to talk about that.
Okay. I don't want to imply any kind of...
No. It's just...
great guilt here, but...
There is no guilt. It was a gift.
Right.
It's a gift to a little boy from a grandfather, and 6 years ago, no one would have thought twice about it.
Right.
And it could be said that, you know, the flip side of this is, if he's not guilty, this gift means nothing.
Of course. You know, no, I'm not saying that the gift means anything, but what I'm saying is, when we go back to the conversation, I'm pressing you a little bit unfairly, or maybe even a lot unfairly. I'm saying, were there knives in the doctor's bag, scalpels?
There were an assortment of typical doctor's tools. It was a doctor's bag with a microscope, his microscope. Uh-huh. And a bunch of doctor's tools, including a couple scalpel things, which seemed to be blunted, but I don't know. I was 4 years old.
Right. But they were inappropriate and taken away, basically.
I'm not saying they're inappropriate. Who am I to say that? Okay. You know, I was four. I appreciated the gift for my grandfather.
Okay.
I'm sure the sharper objects were taken away as you would take away from any kid.
Yeah.
So that's the whole story.
Okay, but let's just be clear. This is not a toy doctor's bag. This is
no.
A real...
Yeah.
And he hadn't been a doctor since the 40s.
Hadn't been a doctor.
So this is...
But you have to understand
this is
that
the real McCoy, though. I'm just saying.
Yeah, but you have to understand that I received a lot of gifts from him all my life.
No, and that's
and
why
this was
I
want to
clarify that, too.
Yeah, it wasn't like one special gift at my... Not my birth or my... As I come into awareness, I received many things from him all my life.
No, I understand that. But let's give an example of the one that you told me afterwards, the train. You're 23.
Right. Here's very... So I experienced behavior from my grandfather, which other people experience from him. And that is, I feel that I feel he had a very hard time understanding his children, or in this case his grandchildren's age. Like, it seemed very amorphous to him. Like, well, so when I'm four, I got this just very detailed, complex gift of a microscope and tools. And yet when I'm 24, 20 years later, we were walking through San Francisco one day, taking a beautiful stroll, and he stopped by a souvenir shop and bought me this little tiny kid's trolley train and gave it to me with a look on his face that sort of told me that I should really value this. and that was typical of him. And I can say that because my uncles and aunts and other relatives tell me similar stories, that he just had, it seemed to be that he has a hard time understanding
being age appropriate.
Yeah, or being age appropriate.
Well, maybe this is because on some level, I promise you, I'm not trying to read something super diabolical.
I read what you want. It's fun.
I promise I'm not.
But I'm speaking from my point of view.
I get it. But it seems to me that if he's a boy genius, et cetera, and he's playing in the Shrine Auditorium at 9, and he's in termites and all of this, he might not ever have been a boy in a way himself. Mm. You know, that he's immediately launched into the adult world.
Yeah.
By doing adult things from a very early age because he was gifted.
I think that's a terrific
When we come to the doctor's bag and the toy train years later, you almost see a picture of a guy who just can't relate to age. He's kind of ageless in a sense.
Yeah. I think it's a great stab and an idea. Yeah. I buy that. Sure.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, go on.
No. What you just said is just resonating, and I feel that to be true.
It's accurate, yeah.
You know, I have a series of Polaroids of me and him together, and I think it was around the same time, honestly. And I like that there's so few of them in this in particular batch. Mm-hmm. I think it's a series of 8. And it's me on his lap playing around, playing with his watch and stuff like that. And they range from sort of a typical grandfather, grandson picture, like, oh, I'm proud to be with my grandson, and me beaming on his knee, and to a couple pictures where we're quite engaged and playing. And then there's a couple pictures which I read now as him just being utterly baffled as to what to do with a 4-year-old.
Right.
So yeah.
Okay. Well, then let's skip ahead to where we ended the last tape then.
Okay.
We're in 1950, and we're back with Lillian Lenorak. So we had the facilitator last time read the Lillian Lenorak letter. What did you feel when you were hearing that letter?
I felt...
I gave you a copy of it, too.
You do? Yeah, I have it. I felt and still do feel very confused. Not by what the letter means, but...
By that person that you don't know?
Yeah, by that person I don't know, and just, well, the strength of its authenticity. If what she's saying is true, it's not good.
Right. Well, if you don't mind, let me take a stab at it.
Let me just add one more thing. And I bring that up because as we've mentioned before, I've spent a lot of time vacillating between full acceptance and full denial, and I think where I am now, and hopefully will stay, I suspect I'll stay, is having to live with I don't know, which is incredibly hard. Mm-hmm. But something like that, which you read, throws a monkey wrench in my relationship to living with I don't know.
Right.
This is sounding vague, I'm sure, but...
It's not at all, actually.
Because it forces me to go down the Black Dahlia rabbit hole again and examine it again, and that's right. Not fun.
I mentioned earlier that, you know, Sarah's in my book is about, it's about taking an idea that Steve had and didn't develop completely and blowing that out to look at it from all the different angles. But in order for me to get to the place where I was comfortable writing the book about your grandfather with Sarah, I needed to be convinced that actually what Steve was talking about was not a bunch of hubbaloo. And for me, the Lillian Lenorak, I should say the Mary Unkefer letter about the Lillian Lenorak episode is a critical place to enter. Because if you just read it backwards, if you start from the very last line, I do not know that this information will be of any help to you. It is about all I could tell you if I came down personally. But if there is anything I can do to help, and anything that is good and sincere, I am at your service. Very sincerely yours, Mary H. Unkefer. This is a policewoman who ironically and bizarrely had a run-in with the Black Dahlia 7 years earlier, who when Elizabeth Short was in trouble for underage drinking, she sort of took her under her wing. Elizabeth Short stayed at her home, and then she kind of got her shipped back out to Massachusetts and helped her out of the state. And here she is again, you know, a beat patrol woman just doing her job, and she's supposed to show up at the home of the doctor on this evening. And the trouble that is described in that letter, I won't go over it all again, is it's so specific, and it's so violent, and it's so ugly. And she's saying, she's signing this letter. It's clear that she doesn't know in the letter until halfway through it, you know, she didn't know where she was. So the letter is not politicized. It's not part of the district attorney's investigation. It's not part of any kind of seeming overarching conspiracy theory. It's just a beat officer showing up at the house to take care of a problem. And what she writes about is so terrible. And if you're going to think about whether it's true or not, in order to believe it's a lie, you would have to believe that she's lying, that the little boy who got knocked down by your grandfather is lying, that Lillian is lying, that Joe Barrett is lying, essentially that everybody is lying.
Yeah.
And when you realize that, that allows you to reel back and say, this letter is urgently authentic.
Right.
So when you look at some of the things that are going on in the letter, you have Joe Barrett talking about the fact that your father paid off $15,000. He's boasting that the $15,000 he paid Jerry Geisler was used to influence the district attorney. You could read that as true or not, because Joe Barrett, who's kind of a wishy-washy guy, is saying it. But the amazing thing about this letter and about many of these documents is that they cross-reference themselves to other documents. So, for example, on the district attorney's transcripts, here's George Hodel saying, without any kind of criminal intention, I've got $15,000 against my house. So you've got him saying, I got $15,000 against my house. And then here you've got Joe Barrett saying, the amount is exactly matching.
Yeah.
He's saying $15,000 went to pay off Jerry Geisler. Went to pay off the district attorney's office. So, you know, no matter where you go in this letter, you have a kind of a vision of truth that allows you to go back and forth with the other documents, numerous cross-referential points to the other documents. So I wanted to explain to you that it's not just enough to look at the timeline in a linear way, you know, like we did last time. You also have to see that all the things cross-reference each other. For example, in the district attorney's transcripts, he's talking about insurance fraud, and there you have in the Los Angeles Times an article about insurance fraud. So the two things are locking together and becoming interwoven. One document not criminal supporting another one that is criminal.
Yeah.
And so I realize I'm not doing a great job of it here, but I'm trying to explain that in order to get to where we got in writing our book, I had to be first comfortable with the fact that criminality is a deep issue here. So
did you come to that point? Where did you come to? And
yeah, I think if
your starting point for to write your book, how did you arrive there?
Well, the idea starts with the art, but the art is a theoretical idea, so the art has to be qualified by the backstory, or it has to be supported by the backstory, by my estimation. If I can't make peace with the backstory, I can't write a theoretical piece about art, because it has no mooring, no root.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I found in the Lillian Lenorak episode, in the Ruth Spaulding episode, in the investigation and him being named as a prime suspect in the Black Dahlia murder, and then also in the incest trial,
yeah,
was enough of an interwoven story where one document is cross-referencing another in such a manner that between 1945 and 1950, there was enough of a picture of a man engaging in criminal behavior to say, yes, it warrants looking at him as a suspect in the Black Dahlia murder. And I've yet to come up with something that convinces me that he did it, but I had to make peace with, I realize I already just said this five different ways. I had to make peace with the fact that we could move forward, mm-hmm. you know? So.
Once you made that decision, did you look back? Were there ever doubts? Were you comfortable with it?
Oh, for sure. For sure. Well, not so much with the criminality. I think I've made my peace with that. I think that the case that your grandfather is in trouble is ironclad in a way,
yeah.
for me. He's engaging in behavior that is, you know, by my look at it, amoral and violent and abusive. He fits a type that could have done it, and clearly they thought so too, because you have to remember that the Los Angeles Police Department, the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office, and the FBI are all looking at him. So, and that they're wiretapping his house. They're not putting taps on his phones. They're actually going into his home and putting microphones into the home. That's a significant development. Even today, I mean, that's a huge yeah. undertaking to go to all this trouble on one guy.
Hmm.
So,
what happened to those?
I don't know.
Are there any ideas what might have happened to them?
No idea. Well, that's the crazy thing. We know the FBI. We know from some documents the FBI was looking into him. No FBI documents. Where are they? We know that the Los Angeles Police Department was looking into him. No Los Angeles Police Department documents. The Los Angeles District Attorney's documents are a result of essentially a botched Los Angeles Police Department investigation. I mean, they were trying to find someone for 2 years. Obviously, they didn't. So that the District Attorney's Office is called in to try to figure out the mess, you know. So that document from October 28th where your granddad is listed as a prime suspect, that's one thing we should clarify from the story,
yeah.
is that it sounds like the incest trial happens and then he suddenly becomes a suspect.
Yeah.
That's what it looks like on paper.
On paper it does.
But that's not
true.
That's probably not true.
Yeah.
Because in order to be in the grand jury's paperwork and to be a prime suspect by that point, by October 28th of 1949, you don't get there overnight. You've got to have a long series of...
But do you think, this is perhaps stating the obvious, but do you think the Tamar event put a bunch of focus on him and that just...
Certainly that's possible. Certainly that's true.
I mean...
And certainly you can't look at Tamar's... you know, Tamar maintains that the police were watching the house in the summer of 1947, but you can't rely on that either because they could have been having a donut outside. You know, they could have been investigating George Hodel for something else.
Right.
So you don't know that they're talking about the Black Dahlia event. You have to look at it from every possible angle. But you do know, or I do know, or I am at least comfortable with the fact that
Remind me one more time. I know we've been through this, but my imagination keeps going back to this moment. Remind me the timeline, or remind me the date that Tamar's trial ends, and then he is now being wiretapped.
Her trial is he's acquitted.
He's acquitted.
December 24th.
Yeah,
1949. And then the wiretaps, then the Lenorek episode, this thing here,
yeah.
is January 30, or the letter from the police officer is January 30.
Okay.
For an event that's in between there somewhere, 1 month.
Okay.
And then about 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, February 18, the tapes start. and that goes till March 24.
Hmm. Wow.
But you know, in the letter, you've got him, according to Lillian, who it should be said is mentally unstable.
Yeah.
She actually goes on to be murdered by another man, unrelated, but, you know, has a terrible life, goes on to not live much longer, obviously mixed up in with pretty bad people. But, you know, you've got Mary Unkerfer saying that Lillian is telling her that she's never tried to kill herself, that the doctor gives her lots of drugs, and when she wakes up, the cutting has been done. And then you've got scratches all over her face, body, and neck, and then you've got the little boy saying, "Granddad knocked my mommy down. Your granddad knocked my mommy down." So it's uncomfortable, you know, it's ugly, but I think, you know, I started by talking about her cordial sign-off. To me, is it, you know, it's obviously coming from the heart, and it's obviously it's just someone saying, if I can help you figure this out, I will, but there's not much more I can tell you.
Yeah.
And that's what gives it a ring of honesty to me, you know.
Let's go back to the springboard into your book and to coming to terms with the criminality before you can start.
Mm-hmm.
So you and Sarah Bayless decided to pursue it wholeheartedly. What happened next? How did you do that?
I guess what I should say, to clarify that, what I should say is I recognize that what we have here is what you might call a conjunction of coincidence. A lot of what we're talking about seems to be coincidental. So if you go back to May 2003, when I read Steve's book, it immediately resonates with me. Like, I understand something. I just get it. I don't know how I can explain that other than, you know, it's like blowing in the wind or something. You know, it's just there and I grab it. So I run with that. Wow, look at this, look at that. But I'm not looking at it like George the criminal. I'm looking at it only theoretically. Like, the art, is this possible? Could this be right? Does that puzzle piece fit? Oh, yeah. You know, Man Ray and Marcel Duchamp are best friends. I remember that from art history. Let me go back and re-research that. Oh, yeah, the Etang Donnet, look at this. That's enough to drive me till about November 2004, when it really becomes, okay, this has to be real.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no question, I think, in my mind that there's a book here. It's just that when I get to November 2004, the question becomes, and I mention that date because I think that's the date that the second edition of Steve's book came out, that was the time where I really needed to see how okay I was with, because to pin a murder on somebody is huge. You know, it's just not fair to do that to somebody unless it warrants it. You know, it's, The guy's not even here to defend himself anymore. So it seems to me that you need to know what you're talking about. And so that time, I just, in addition to moving forward with the art thing, I had to be okay with, is what Steve's saying, what part of it is real? And, you know, I guess that's a question back to you too, because in our conversations, it sometimes seems that you're a little bit stopped at what is Steve's intention instead of what is Steve's evidence.
What do you mean? I don't follow.
Well, let me give you an example. This is kind of I feel the least articulate I've ever felt in one of these sessions today. I'm not sure why. But let me give you an example. I'm 12 years old, okay? I'm a boy. I'm in church. I went to a Lutheran church. And it was one of these weird churches where, you know, it's like a neighborhood church. My parents went there. I went there. So, and it was kind of a strange church in that it rolled with the times, you know. If it was the Carter years, it was kind of liberal, and the pastor was kind of a, what you'd think of as a genuine kind of guy, a good
right.
pastor. And then you roll into another time period, and, you know, another pastor would come, and he'd be this ridiculous character who got real hot under the collar and gave these absurd sermons about the evils of the Easter Bunny or homosexuality or whatever. And around about 12, they had these traveling people called the Peters Brothers come mm-hmm. around, and they had this event where their gimmick was they would go around and talk about the evils of rock and roll. I remember going to this because rock and roll, that's something I'm interested in. Gee, you go to church for that, you know? So they show these slides of like record covers, like the Eagles, Hotel California or whatever. And they're showing all the satanic symbolism in these ridiculous record covers, you know? And I remember they showed very vividly, I remember they showed the Jethro Tull record cover, which was took the book of Genesis and inverted it. So it says something like, in the beginning, man created God and blah, blah, blah. And I remember having this epiphany, like, wow, that makes way more sense to me. It was like church did the exact opposite thing it was supposed to do for me. It actually convinced me that I really shouldn't believe in God. So cut forward many years, I go to college, learn all about evolution. Not the concept of it, but the actual science of it, you know, selection pressures mm-hmm. and variation of a species and, you know, geological time frames. So now I've got the data to enhance a belief system or to solidify it. I'm an agnostic. I don't believe in God. There's the impelling event, but then there's the data, and they're very different things. So if you're talking about Steve's book, for example, where does the belief system come from? For Steve, for example, or you or me, it's different. But for Steve, it comes from those photographs. But you can take those photographs and you can lop it off like it's a gangrene arm.
Exactly.
But the rest of the organism is still there. In my analogy, the evidence is still there.
Yeah.
I could have gone through my entire life, not had that experience as a boy, not had that epiphany, but still come to college and gotten the data.
Yeah.
And I would still find myself at the same place without the epiphany or without the little aha moment or whatever you want to call that. So in Steve's book, what I'm asking you is, can you cut that away, like remove it? It doesn't matter what Steve's intention was in releasing this book. It doesn't matter what his, you know, what his, what's driving that. But I still see the data.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Well, that's where you and I are different. And it's to do with blood.
No, for sure. But what I'm asking is, this is not a rhetorical question. It's an actual question to you.
Yeah.
How is it? I mean, I get it, but I guess I want you to articulate it. You know, are you protecting something and not wanting to cut that part of it off?
I think there's two things happening. I think on a rational level, I've spent my life studying intent and behavior as a theater artist. That's what I do. I mean, right. I want to understand behavior. I want to understand action and choices and intent. I'm fascinated by this. This is all I really care about. It's all I watch all day long.
Right.
But unfortunately, something's happened in my own family that I'm sort of hyper-vigilant in studying what his intent may be, because I really think he's so incredibly talented. He's really quite skilled, I think. He's come up with some amazing ideas, mm-hmm. but I think he's very skilled in adjusting the lens on how to perceive things. I think he's very good at it. Like the inciting incident, for example. I think he's incredibly skilled in making a reader believe that this magical gift appeared and it was in actuality, and then he had this epiphany, and it might be that that's not true at all. And in fact, the pictures might not even be her. So I guess what I'm saying is I'm calling into question his intent, because parts of his story weaken if it turns out that he has other motives besides just this great discovery. And of course he does. I mean, who wouldn't?
For sure he does. But what I'm saying, again, yeah. if I rephrase the question just again.
Yeah.
If you take away that, let's take all of that, Steve's intent.
Right. His, I see what you're saying.
And you just put that over, you put that over in a box.
Yeah.
And you say, okay, Steve, the being that is Steve, his intention, and you just put that all away.
You just take the proof. You just take
I'm
the
asking
fossils.
You to do the, yeah, I'm doing yeah. so I'm asking I've, you to do something nearly impossible, right. separate no, the no, blood no. anxiety I've, from I've this
been working on that for a long time.
And you only come to the data like the Lillian Lenorak letter or the Mary I should say the Mary Unkefer letter, which doesn't in and of itself has none of Steve's intent in it. It's simply a letter written from a police officer to the Los Angeles District Attorney's office. It seems to indicate a great degree of violence.
There's no doubt. I'm not doubting that. I'm not doubting that my grandfather wasn't positively a complex, even violent man, and I've been witness to that. And I'm nor am I saying that I don't believe that in the Hollywood years, as we call them, things that didn't happen. Shouldn't have happened, didn't happen. And my own family will come out and say, as they recently have, that things went wrong. But there's a difference between this letter and the behavior of this letter, which, and killing the Black Dahlia.
There is. I don't disagree with that.
There is no doubt that he was a difficult, complex person, and I'm not saying that. I'm just
those are generous words, by the way.
No, well, there's still no proof, in actuality, that he had incest with Temer. There really isn't. There's strong evidence, or if there's stories to be believed, but he was acquitted. And you can believe Tamar, and you can believe Steve, and you can believe other people, but there is no proof.
I will grant you that your grandfather was never convicted of any crime. So right. if I ever forget to use the word alleged, for right. example, I apologize in advance.
And I do this for myself because I find myself playing both sides of the fence because that's where my mind's at. But it's my own family which reminds me of this. Like, I probably brought this example up, but I was with my grandmother recently, and she says, well, you know, they found a shoe or a footprint by the crime scene, and I was his wife. That's not his shoe size.
Yeah, but
I mean, for a million arguments, there's a flip side, you know?
Yeah, but remember, there's also a great possibility that whoever killed the Black Dahlia did not do it alone. Because,
yeah.
remember, all the organs in her body are perfectly contained in each half of her body, and that body had to be moved.
Right.
That's a very, very complex undertaking. So that shoe print, again, if you want to flip the coin over again, it doesn't have to have been George, just because he could have been working with
what I'm saying
another
is,
person.
What I'm saying is that just because he might have been a misogynistic, womanizing, maybe even incestuous father, does not mean he was a killer.
I think we actually agree on this point, because for me to come to the place where I was able to be okay with proceeding in our yeah. book, we're just simply saying
right.
he had all of the tendencies and the right, right inclinations exactly. to make him a prime suspect.
Exactly.
Which is, you understand why the LAPD, why the district attorneys, and why the FBI were looking at him.
Yeah.
Because he fits.
He has all the ingredients.
He has all of the ingredients, well, and they're said. All set in place.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean he did it.
Right.
And we don't know that he did it. I should say that Lillian Lenorak actually is the person that says that Elizabeth Short was his girlfriend. But again, I want to qualify that and say that she also, this is afterwards when Frank Jemison comes to interview her. She might be feeling safe already at this point in the Camarillo Hospital.
Yeah.
Why not make up something else? So even though she's a person that ties George to Elizabeth Short, you have to discount that part of her story because it's...
I know we're coming to we're again down on the clock, but what this brings up for me, and I've only been able to articulate it right now, and that is, I'm glad we had this conversation today, and new ideas are occurring to me. And that is, it's a human tendency, or it's my tendency, and I believe it's probably a universal one, to try to categorize degrees of intent or degrees of evil. Mm-hmm. Because it can help me survive, and it can help me fathom. And I can fathom that guy. I can fathom the guy in that letter. I can. It's terrible. Because I know that history has proven him to turn into a warm and loving grandfather.
To you.
To me. Yeah. But, you know, just because he did this doesn't mean he did the next thing. And for the same, and I could be said that just because, what if he did kill a Black Dahlia? Doesn't mean that he killed 20 other people in LA, or that he sent those crazy letters to the newspaper. Yeah, it's kind of an epiphany to me.
Well, let me ask you this. I talked about this little moment where I had, where I'm in church, right?
Yeah.
This is a one moment in my life, radical, earth-changing moment. My belief system changes in that one moment.
Yeah.
Is it possible? Is it conceivable to you that, I know you talk about going back and forth, but is it possible that, and I'm, in my belief system right now, I know exactly where I am. I know what the boundaries of it are.
Yeah.
And I know that it's a changeable thing. I believe it today, but it doesn't mean I'm going to believe it tomorrow. I believe that George Hodel should be considered a prime suspect in the murder of Elizabeth Short. That's a belief system. But if somebody tomorrow came and said to me, we found the smoking gun, I'd be overjoyed. You know, my belief system would be overturned.
Right.
So I'm just wondering, like, you know, when you have a belief system that, for example, that comes out of your family about who Tamar is supposed to be for you, for example, I'm wondering, is there some kind of, could you imagine a day where you just woke up and said to yourself, I know I've been taught to not believe Tamar all these years, but I just believe her today, for example.
But I've already had that. Yeah. I've already had that moment. But right. But it changes.
Every day it changes.
Right? Yeah, because there's no definitive proof on either end, and that's what's so vexing about this. Mm-hmm. I want it. You know what? I would probably be happier knowing for certain. I would probably rest easier, really.
But let me ask you this. Why would a grown woman, she has every chance in the world to just let it go away. Why would a grown woman keep...
Because she's been called a liar all her life. I mean, for every idea one you can throw out there, I mean, if you're going to ask me,
I could have an answer. Why would she keep going on it? Sure you could, but give me one. Why would she keep going on it?
Because she's been outcast for 50 years by her entire family, and she's angry about it. Yeah. I mean, that could be one answer. Mm-hmm. The other answer is she's not lying, and it's true.
Yeah.
But, you know, I have a sister who is 28, and she is mentally disabled. She's crazy. Mm-hmm. She's schizoaffective and schizophrenic. And she talks about things in her childhood.
In your childhood?
In our childhood. She's 8 years younger than me.
8 years younger. Uh-huh.
With such conviction and such clarity of memory to her, but in actuality has nothing to do with actually what transpired. I bring it up as an example, as like, yes, she can be fully convicted as to what she remembers having transpired. Right. So it's difficult. It's difficult. And you know what? I think I'm healthy for trying to come to this with an open mind. Most of my family, their only choice is to say no.
Right.
And I think I'm the one making the more difficult and more mature choice, excuse me, by saying maybe.
Right.
And if the day comes that someone can say, guess what, boss? It's done. He's on tape. Or here is the proof. I mean, if it's definitive, I might have a sigh of relief. I don't know. I don't know that that's true, but it could happen.
Right. Do we have any time left or we're done?
5 seconds.
5 seconds.
We'll do one more.
We'll make 1 minute.
1 minute. Got 1 minute left.
So,
this has been an exasperating session for me. I'm not sure why. I guess sometimes you roll with it and you're at ease with it, and sometimes you.
I can't
get it out right. I can't say what I'm feeling correctly.
But I think if you go and let time pass and look back upon it, yeah. I think that exasperation will be interesting and telling and possibly productive.
Yeah, yeah. I have no intention or desire to edit these sessions that we do in any way or cut them up into little pieces, because they're better this way, even with the frustration.
I agree.
Well, I know we're out of time, so... It's StoryCorps is so bizarre this way. You feel like you have all the time in the world and yet no time at all. So we'll just end today, and then we'll have one more session.
Sure,
we'll
can wrap it up.
Finish this discussion.
I might, between now and then, I might have some epiphany and have a different choice.
Okay. All right. Talk to you soon.